In pursuit of the right to self-determination, Palestinian people use force to resist foreign oppression and complete the establishment of an independent state. Its inalienable right, well-founded in international law. Various people freed themselves from colonial rule and foreign oppression to realize independent statehood after World War II. Their practices serve as convincing evidence for the right. Numerous AGA resolutions recognize legitimacy of struggling by all available means, including armed struggle by peoples under colonial domination or foreign occupation to realize the right to self-determination. For instance, the UNGA Resolution 3070 of 1973, I quote, reaffirms the legitimacy of the people's struggle for liberation from colonial and foreign domination and alien subjugation by all available means, including armed struggle, end of quote. This recognition is also reflected in international convention. For example, the Arab Convention for Suppressing of Terrorism of 1998 affirms, I quote, the right of peoples to combat foreign occupation, aggression by whatever means, including armed struggle, in order to liberate their territories and secure the right to self-determination and independence. End of quote.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of West Bank Robbery. I'm Bass and my co-host, AP, which today stands for Asian Palestinian. We are joined today by Carl Zah. I'm a longtime fan from the Silk and Steel podcast. He's a many-time guest on Radio Warner, which is where I first heard about him. And I've also been working through his chronological history of China series. I'm only 400 episodes in. There's a lot of history. I don't know where they got it all from. How you doing, Carl?
Hi, how are you? Bassam, good to see you.
Yeah, I'm very glad that we got you on. I was worried that you'd be too busy surfing or, I don't know, flying a Chengdu J-20 or something.
I haven't been surfing for a while, unfortunately, because I got an injury and now have a kid. I have a kid and another one on the way, so been busy lately. I like to get
all
back
right.
to surfing.
All right, congratulations.
Yeah, I remember what happened.
I'm trying to be an evolutionary success. This is
a little off topic, but something that I was kind of interested in. What is childcare like in Indonesia? Here in the U.S., it is absolutely crushing. We pay my wife, her entire paycheck basically goes to childcare. It's like she either works or stays home with the kid, and it's the same thing. We don't make any money either way.
I lucked out because in Indonesia the labor is plentiful and we have a living nanny. We pay her like the ongoing rate, which is about between $300 and $400 per month. We cover her. She lives with us. We cover her food, her lodging, and everything. But so that's like from a U.S. perspective, that's just cheap. And, you know, my salary is significantly reduced since I moved to Bali. But, I still make enough to be able to afford to have a living nanny, to help with our kid, which really helps significantly because it allows my wife to continue to pursue her own career. And
that's great. Yeah, so that's great. Yeah. I mean, my wife, she grew up with an au pair from Sweden, I believe, or Norway. I forget exactly. And that was more of an option when we were growing up than now. Now it is totally out of the reach of any middle class American, which is difficult. The childcare is pretty
difficult. I will say that I am available. If anybody needs, I'm a green belt. The kid's safe. You know, I'll go anywhere. I don't have any roots. I'll go wherever. I'm not tied down to this place. I'll do it for that going rate. I don't care. As long as you give me shelter, maybe dental. But yeah. Oh, but either way, guys, what we're here to talk about today is Palestine and China, their relationship through the ages. China has a very interesting history with the Middle East, stronger and softer at times. I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on like the current state of things. But before we get to that, I want to talk about Aaron Bushel and the self-immolation outside the Israeli embassy in D.C. I've been to many protests at that fucking embassy, and I've like stood right where that guy died. So this shit kind of hit me pretty heavy. I don't know. It seems like, you know, he's gotten the PFLP, Hamas, Ayatollah Khomeini, you know, just like all these organizations. He's kind of become like a bit of a rock star in the Middle East. I don't know. AP, you got any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously his last words were, I think, especially devastating for me when he said, this is what the ruling class has decided will be normal. This really hit, you know, I think that really to the heart of this. This is, you know, what our the ruling class here in the West has decided is going to be normal going forward. And seeing that, I mean, the footage was really horrifying, but this is what's decided for us. I mean, especially as we, you know, climate catastrophe, you know, rages on. I mean, what happens when, you know, 50 million, you know, people are immigrating around the world? And people say that, oh, well, we can just, you know, starve to death a million people. That's just okay. That's totally fine. In a rules-based international order. I mean, so that's, yeah, those are kind of like my initial thoughts.
Yeah, that's kind of something that I always try to stress to people, especially when they're like, why do these random assholes care about Palestine? You know, they're just fucking, they're anti-Semitic or something. Like, I'm Palestinian, so they can't like pull that line on me because I'm like from there. But like, Palestine's your future. If that shit does not get taken care of, it's like the laboratory for all sorts of, you know, automated turrets mounted on walls around borders and that kind of shit. That's coming if we don't take care of it. Any thoughts on this, Tom? How's this reaching the news over there?
Actually, Aaron Bushnell is also going viral in the Chinese social media space. I was reading a lot of comments on Douyin, which is the Chinese version of TikTok. Because Chinese, they have a domestic version of TikTok, which is Douyin, and they have the international version, which is known as TikTok. And
oh yeah, AP's on there all the time. He's learning math.
And, oh, you know, Douyin is great. I consider like Douyin content much more wholesome, much more interesting than whatever is on TikTok. And I actually made myself an account just to browse. And what some of the Chinese comment I've seen is like, Aaron Bushnell is a hero that America doesn't deserve, and they're saying, you know, he's a real Captain America, and yeah, there's a lot of Chinese digital artist Wu Heqiling actually made a digital art of Aaron Bushnell, which I tweeted out on my Twitter account. So, you know, he's worldwide now, you know, not just Middle East, US. He's, you know, I mean, everybody know who he is, what he stood for, which doubly ironic because if you look at all the mainstream media reporting in US, Washington Post, well, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, they just says, oh, the US airman burn himself, you know, without even mentioning his last words in the headline or why he chose to end his life. You know, but you know,
yeah, you think he just fucking stepped on a match or fell into a puddle of gasoline. It's fucking ridiculous. That NPR article in particular, they've edited it now, but you can probably still find the original. It was just fucking,
yeah. NPR has gotten progressively worse in the last 10 years. I mean, now it's pretty much just straightforward State Department propaganda.
A friend of mine always says NPR is always better in wartime. That's when they really pull out the big guns.
I mean, I think that's kind of one of the most genius things about this act of protest was that Aaron was able to cut through all of that, all of the media narrative, any ability to control what his words were. He filmed it. He live streamed it. He sent it out to all of these, you know, media outlets so they could get a hold of it before it was clamped down on, and alternative media outlets, groups like Crime Think, you know, and he filmed it really well.
Yeah, it was very genius. I mean, yeah, it was fucking genius.
This is a Zoomer. I mean, this is a Zoomer. This is not a millennial guy. This is a TikTok generation guy. He filmed it like a TikTok dance video. I mean, we're talking about, you know, TikTok and Douyin. I mean, people have adopted a totally different way of acting in the world. And Aaron had captured that and saw how to use that to spread this message worldwide. And that's the real, for me, the genius of this.
And the fact that he's a U.S. serviceman, you know, like now the U.S. establishment has managed to alienate its recruitment pool for the U.S. empire, both on the right and the left, right? I mean, this is why we're having a recruitment crisis for the U.S. military. They can't even staff their super aircraft carrier four because, you know, people are just sick and tired of fighting the war for empire. Nobody wants to die for Israel. Nobody want. I mean, over 66% of the Americans want immediate ceasefire in Palestine, and the politicians we have are completely oblivious to the popular opinions inside United States. And what Aaron Bushnell's act is to make sure the popular opinion can no longer be brushed under the carpet.
Yeah, I think it's really, I hope it's shaken up at least like the military establishment or something. They should be at least a little bit worried. I've seen some stuff that say that they're very concerned and they're kind of scrambling to try to contain this. I don't know if they're going to be able to, but yeah, you know, like with things like this, like it's always like the worry that like it'll just get ignored or like the guy will be forgotten. But like, I think this was pretty successful, and I don't think Aaron Bushnell is going anywhere.
Well, I mean, they have. I mean, this is as I mean, I remember Bassem telling me now several years ago when the gentleman burned himself in protest of inaction on climate change in D.C. that people do this all the time, and that's really unfortunate that you know the U.S. has become so inured to death that this is a regular protest and it can just be pushed under the rug. And again, I mean, I really have to hand it to Aaron that he was able to cut through all of that. Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that about says it. Let's get on to his relationship. So let's go back. I'll start us off here. We go way back. Do the Chinese know about Arabs? Yes, they do. The Silk Road exists. So they've been dipping in and out of there. They've had a much more long-term relationship with the Middle East than, say, the United States has, or the UK or France. They've had a much more long-term economic relationship with the things kind of slowed down in the, like, 18th century.
Yeah, I mean, there's no comparison, right? The U.S. only has, like, what, less than 300 years of history. And China, Arab relationships dates back thousands of years. You know, as soon as we have documented sources, as soon as almost immediate. I mean, there has always been a maritime Silk Road that runs through South China to the Indian Ocean, and the Indian Ocean Basin trade has been running for thousands of years. And then after the advent of Islam, and we have documented arrival of Muslims on the shore of China as early as, 7th century, pretty shortly after the advent of Islam on the peninsula. You have mosques in Guangzhou, China, that dates from that period, over 1,000-year-old mosques. And there's Arab and Persian communities all along the coast of China. When Marco Polo went to China, he found these thriving communities of Arab and Persian merchants on the southeastern Chinese coast. They have established communities and they have put down roots because they usually take on local wives. So at that time, the trade is carried on by determined by the monsoon winds, because the monsoon winds in Indian Ocean, they blow one direction for 6 months and then they switch direction for another 6 months. So what people do is when the, you know, when the wind blows one direction, the traffic, for example, they will travel from Arabia to China, and they will stay in China and Southeast Asia for 6 months, do trading, and then they catch the boat, sail back. So in China, and they form new communities. This is how the Muslim community in China got started. And so, yeah, so, I mean, obviously it's has longer history than United States. I mean, United States only have a couple hundred years of history. But this,
yeah, when you put it like that, Islam's kind of the China of the 7th century, you know, real meteoric industrial rise. There's not paying taxes is a great deal. Yeah. Okay. So let's zoom back a bit. The Chinese know about Arabs. We get that. They've been around way long. What is China's early relationship? Let's start with the, I'm not too particularly interested in the, like pre-communist periods, like involvement with Palestinians specifically, just because, you know, Chinese and Palestinian nationalism kind of, they came up a bit later, and they both kind of like matured around the same time, I feel like. Talk to me about like early communist China's like perceptions of the Middle East and like the ways they dealt with it. I understand that many countries in the Middle East were some of the first to recognize the People's Republic and like, you know, support their bid to get their like UN Security Council seat and that kind of thing. Though Israel was the first one. I don't know if anybody asked that much for them. I think they just kind of threw that out there. Yeah, tell me a little bit about that.
Oh, you're... Sorry, you're cutting out a little bit. What is the time frame you're talking about?
Let's go with like mid-40s to like early 50s period. Like, what was the like very early relationship with the Middle East? I understand China was very diplomatically isolated, but well, it found some of its first footholds
right, I mean,
in the international community
in
the Middle East.
I mean, immediately after World War II, China... The Chinese Civil War got started. So the Chinese were pretty busy fighting themselves for a good 4 years until 1949, the establishment of the People's Republic. So it's interesting because right after this, the establishment of the People's Republic of China, China has always supported the Palestinian self-determination. In fact, in 1955, when the Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai went to the Bandung Conference, aka the first Afro-Asiatic conference that was held in Bandung, Indonesia, attended by mostly nations that coming out of the new decolonial struggle in Asia and Africa, China was very explicit in supporting the Palestinian right of return. And this is also the Bandung Conference is also what really freaked out the CIA because they saw all these decolonized countries coming together, you know, forming the Long Aligned Movement that was kind of outside of the Cold War framework, and
it was a really big deal. It represented over half of the world's population at this conference. And it's also where China picked up a bunch more votes to give them their Security Council.
Exactly. And, you know, basically China and India at that time kind of emerged as a leader of the non-aligned movement. And, you know, there's also attended by, I think Nassar and attended the meeting. I believe I see a photo of him with Zhou Enlai and also the Indonesian president Sukarno. And at that time, Indonesia is also, you know, trying to build socialism in Indonesia. The Indonesian Communist Party at that time was the world's third largest communist party after Soviet Union and China. So this really freaked out CIA, and that led to the 1965 coup, which the CIA helped the Indonesian military massacre 1 million people, suspected communists, suspected leftists, union organizers, and ethnic Chinese. So it was like I came to Bali 4 years ago. The legacy still persists today because a lot of the people, Bali is not a tourist paradise, but a lot of people are not aware of this dark history. So when now developers are bulldozing over beaches to put up hotels, they're still still dugging up mass grave from 1995-96.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, and
is there a lot of Chinese tourism as well?
Yeah,
I imagine. I mean, it's pretty close, right? And is there a lot of consciousness of that in China? The racial nature of the massacre?
Yes. The 1965 massacre was mainly aimed toward the communists, the leftists, but of course, because the ethnic Chinese, by association, because China was a communist state, they also got massacre along with it. But then in 1998, this was during the Asian financial crisis, and the Chinese again became the ethnic Chinese because their predominance over the economy, they became the scapegoat. So there was a massacre in 1998, which is much more fresh in fresh in the memory of people both in China and also among the Chinese Indonesian. You know, like a lot of the Chinese Indonesian I talk about, they still say, you know, they have like suffered PTSD from 1998 because they remember what happened in Jakarta. But there's a lot of tourism in Bali coming from China. Before the COVID time, it was about like over 3 million Chinese tourists visit every year. The COVID took a toll, obviously. And now the tourism from China is slowly coming back, but the airline ticket needs to be, the price needs to come down for the tourism to resume. You know, like this is the problem with China, with United States as well. The U.S. and China just agreed to reopen like 100 more flights between U.S. and U.S. and China. Like I remember when I traveled to China from U.S. in October last year, tickets weren't cheap, and I couldn't get direct flights from JFK to Beijing. I had to fly from Raleigh to JFK and from JFK to Hong Kong and then from Hong Kong to Beijing. So like you added many more hours.
Oh my God.
At least you got out of Raleigh.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry?
At least you got out of Raleigh.
I mean, Raleigh is actually pretty nice. I mean, I chose the time of the year when it's really, really hot in Bali, and I know it's a relatively nice.
You're a snowbird.
I'm a snowbird.
All right, so let's go forward a little, okay? Let's get to the mid-60s. This is when the real interesting stuff comes up. And while I was researching this, like I'm pretty familiar with like the Soviet Union and like the Soviet bloc support and like Yugoslavia and stuff, support for the Palestinians. And I discovered that's because the USSR collapsed and the GDR opened up its archives. I messaged Carl like a week ago. I'm like, I'm waiting on some documents. I'm like requesting some stuff from like the PLO, like research center. And I'm trying to figure out what the Chinese were doing specifically. I thought you would get numbers. Like the Soviets, you can find out, oh, they sent like this many AKs. They trained this many people. There were these meetings. The Chinese state did not collapse. I've been fucking spoiled by the collapse of the Soviet Union. I had like there's really not that much information on like the covert operation and that kind of stuff.
This guy's gonna kill his communist cred by saying he was spoiled by the collapse of the Soviet Union.
They left me that. They left me the sick documents, dude. There's so many documents. I love documents. In the mid-60s, okay, the head of the PLO ends up going to China, and this is kind of the start of the material. Shortly after this, several dozen, maybe over 100-something PLO militants were trained in China. I do know Zhou Enlai was particularly concerned in true guerrilla fashion that you guys don't really have a great country nearby to hang out in and train. But beyond that, they still, you know, they set the weapons and that kind of thing. Talk a little more about this period.
Yeah, because Mao firmly believed in a world revolution, so he supported anti-colonial struggle, national liberation struggle all over the world in Africa, as well Africa, Southeast Asia, Latin America, as well as Palestine. So China funded Palestinian resistance groups, invited them to China to provide military training, provided them with weapons, and they supported the Palestinian Liberation PLO, and they supported both Fatah and also the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine, PFLP, and also the Democratic Front for Liberation of Palestine, DFLP. You know, they supported the whole gamut of them. You can Google and find online of the Palestinian resistance fighters opening up Mao's red book.
That's one of my favorites. That's one of my favorites. That's a baller photo. They've got their guns, the kafirs are wrapped around their face, and they're reading the book. You know, it's good to read. I think that's really the main.
Israeli intelligence.
You look cool while you read.
And Israeli intelligence have discovered like the Chinese training menus, how to use like Chinese weapons, you know, still in Chinese text, right? But with like Arabic translation next to it. And so because this was the period when, you know, even though China was still desperately a poor country, but Mao's firmly believed world revolution corner, and he supported national liberation movement all over the place. That did change in 1978. After Mao's death, you know, Deng Xiaoping came to power, and then Deng Xiaoping made a decision to stop exporting revolution. Now, this was made for several factors. One is that China at that time was surrounded by a lot of hostile anti-communist neighbors. So, and when China exported revolution in 1966, for example, when China sponsored the Burmese communist insurrection and supported the Malaysian communist insurrection, the Filipino communist insurrection, Thailand communist insurrection, this led to, you know, the worsening of ties between China and all its neighboring states. And Indonesia, as already mentioned, after the 1965 coup, Indonesia became very, you know, the Indonesian Communist Party, it got wiped out. And the Indonesian military that came to power was very, the junta under dictator Suharto was led a very anti-communist state. You know, I still remember my wife told me she grew up watching this kind of propaganda film made in Indonesia back then about the coup. And I watched a little bit of it. In the beginning, it just shows the Muslims praying in the mosque, and then these communists come in literally with hammer and sickle attacking people and killing people. This is a kind of the propaganda that was waged on the population at that time. And so in an effort to improve ties with these neighboring countries, in the 1978, Deng Xiaoping cut off all the military to, all over the world. So they stopped exporting revolution. They cut off the military aid to the Palestinian resistance group as well. But China maintained diplomatic support for Palestine. So for example, in 1988, when Palestine PLO declared the establishment of Palestinian state, the Palestinian PLO office in Beijing got turned into the embassy of Palestine in Beijing. And Yasser Arafat has visited China 14 times. And I grew up in China in 1980s. I remember seeing Yasser Arafat on CCTV all the time, on the Chinese state TV all the time. So, you know, he's all referred to as an old friend of China. And the Chinese support for, you know, for the establishment of an independent Palestinian state with its East Jerusalem as its capital has been the stated Chinese policy forever. That has never changed. And what then in 1989, after the Tiananmen Square protests, China was under diplomatic isolation from the West. And then, you know, shortly after, a couple years after, the Eastern Bloc collapsed. There was collapse of the Soviet Union and all the Eastern Bloc countries. So China was trying to break out of the diplomatic isolation. And you went on a diplomatic offensive. That's when China finally established normalizing ties with the anti-communist state like Singapore, Indonesia, and Saudi Arabia, South Korea. But in 1990, around the same time, the peace negotiation, PLO and Israel were way to pay for the signing of Oslo Accord. So then there was a rapprochement between China and Israel that led to the normalization of ties between China and Israel. So when I was in China, I lived in China from my birth in 1990. The period of time I lived in China, China did not recognize the state. Like Israeli citizens could not get a visa to come to China unless they use, you know, unless they have a...
you shouldn't have left. You were fucking holding that wall up. You were there. You left and they fucking changed it. You take your eyes off it for 1 second. The Chinese support, like, I don't know. Sometimes I feel like it's often both understated and overstated in some ways. Like, the DFLP is, like, a great thing to focus on, to, like analyze, like, Chinese involvement in Palestine. They received a lot of weapons and arms and stuff. My dad, being more of a Soviet partisan, I asked him, like, what did the DFLP, because the DFLP, I should mention, listeners, Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, was a more, like, Maoist-aligned group, or, like, more, like, guerrilla, like, Castroist. Like, they were more of a, they were a mid-60s militant organizer, whereas the PFLP was more traditionally, like, hardline, Marxist-Leninist Soviet-style communist. And I asked him, Dad, what did the DFLP do when Mao died? And he... being a little catty, he's like, they were very adaptable. They were very adaptable with their ideology, but they made it work. And I'm like, okay, you gotta respect that. He's like, I really respected it. Those guys, they had those guys in lockstep. They could fucking swivel on anything. But even though China did end up pulling out from a lot of its more like covert, like guerrilla funding, the Palestinians still did receive a lot of support through neighboring countries. Like Egypt ended up getting up a lot of support, like a good amount of support. China was very poor at the time. Like, you have to, like, really consider, like, what they could give. Like, you know, they were doing about as much as Cuba, basically. You know, they just didn't have much in the country. There was so much more to rebuild. Even today, you go to Gaza, you can find these fucking crazy Chinese high caliber assault rifles. They look like something out of Halo Reach or something. They got them from Libya, which the Chinese had sold, like, a bunch of arms to Libya. And, you know, even you look at Yemen, they're still using, like, Chinese missiles. The Iranians are still doing it. The Chinese have, while they may not have given, like, the same, like, pound-for-pound support as the Soviet Union, a lot of their fingerprints have held on a lot longer with a lot of the technological. Overall, you know, China's done a good amount. One thing I am curious of, and I don't understand, I've been trying to figure this out for years at this point. I can't find a good book on it. I'm afraid I'll be lied to. Like, I'm afraid a book will trick me, but I don't know what happened. How did the Sino-Soviet split impact China's like relations with Palestine, or really just guerrilla movements in general in the region? I know, like, China supported the ejection of the Soviet trainers and stuff from Egypt. It seems like they were fucking at each other's throats.
Yeah. So the China Soviet U.S. policy tour the Middle East, it's a fascinating study of diplomacy, because people during the founding of Israel, that's when the Soviet actually supported the state of Israel, because they thought Israel was giving it to the British Imperial before it was a British mandate of Palestine, and they thought by supporting this the Israelis, they're sticking it to the British, and that was later changed. Because the U.S. also was more kind of cool toward the founding of Israel, because U.S. had a long-standing relationship with, for example, the House of Saud in Saudi Arabia. But that all changed in the late 50s and early 60s, and with the Soviet leaning more on the Arab side, and U.S. just went all the way to bat for Israel. Now, the result of Sino-Soviet split is playing out across a global stage. For example, in Angola, they supported different factions, and also
finished up a series on that.
Yeah, and also in the Horn of Africa. But in some cases, in terms of support for Palestine, support for example, the War of Liberation in Vietnam, the China and Soviet policies were largely aligned. But they're aligned, but they're independent of each other. China and Soviet Union weren't speaking terms at this point. So China actually supported all the Palestinian resistance group, you know, not just the Maoist PFLP. It supported Fatah, it supported PFLP, because it rightly saw Israel as the outpost of Euro-American settler colonialism in the Middle East. Like I said, in 1980s, when I was in China, Israeli citizens, they cannot get their visa to China unless they have their dual passport holder. If they have a passport of another country, then that's the only way they can come to China is a visa. That was changed in 1992, because at that time, the peace negotiation between PLO and Israel has already fully underway. Oslo Accord was signed a year later, and China is not going to be more pro-Palestinian than the Palestinian themselves. From that point, you know, China has always advocated, basically from 1990s onward, China has advocated for the two-state solution, with the establishment of independent Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital. And Xi Jinping actually reaffirmed China's position in 2016 when he went to speak at the Arab League conference in Cairo. And a lot of the American commentators were surprised by that. And I remember there was one American podcaster, Eric Oland, runs the China in Africa podcast. And he's like, "Oh my God, why did China do that? You know, that's so stupid." I was like, "What? This is not a new Chinese position. This has been the Chinese position since forever. You know, China has always..." Xi Jinping didn't say anything new. He's reiterating the policy of Mao, policy of Deng Xiaoping. You know, China has always said it supports an independent Palestine and with East Jerusalem as its capital. This Chinese position has never changed.
No, they've just been remarkably consistent. Like, despite, you know, military or, like, financial aid, like, going up and down, they've been remarkably consistent on their, like, positions in, like, international bodies. Like, they never really, like, flip-flopped ever. They've just been very standard. And one thing that I really thought was fucking dope as hell was I believe it was the Chinese UN ambassador. I think it was this week. He just said, he got up at the press conference and he's like, "Legally, Palestinians can fucking kill you guys. Like, they have a right to resist. Like, they're cool, man. This is, like, legal. It's not a crime. They're allowed to fucking do backflips before they, like, blow up your tank. Like, that's just normal. That's international law, dude."
It's really interesting because, us living in the U.S., we have a government that is always preaching rules-based international order, rules-based international order, rules-based international order. But you see, time and time again, it's rules, you know, rules for me, but not for thee. Like any agreement that we have, I mean, this is, Iran is finding this, like any agreement that we have, it can be torn up at any moment. And I think that's kind of what's infuriating a little bit to Americans when they see that China is consistent in policy. Is like, what do you mean you're still honoring your position that you've held? Like, it's almost like an attack on our morals, right? And our convictions. I think that's another big thing. I mean, we already moved on from Aaron Bushnell, but I mean, I think this is a big attack on people is that we see that people who have convictions and actually follow rules and are like, okay, if you say that you're going to do that and I'll say I'm going to do that, then I expect that we're going to follow through with that, you know, at some point later. That's an attack on all the fucking shifty criminals that run our government and run our institutions and our everyone wants to be in this country. It's absolutely wild, and it's really revealing.
Yeah, like American actions have been very consistent on Palestine, but their rhetoric has changed dramatically over and over and over.
The Chinese diplomat Ma Xinmin, who spoke at the ICJ last Thursday, I mean, he's actually a senior Chinese diplomat. He's pretty high up the ranks. And he cited the UN Charter. And he cited, look, it's under the international law, the Palestinian has an inalienable rights to fight against their colonial oppressors. It's not, first of all, China does not, has never labeled Hamas as terrorists. It's like Israel always like, do you condemn Hamas? Do you condemn Hamas? And China is saying, oh, you know, like the anti-colonial struggle is justified under international law. And you know, and he's right that they cited the UN Charter, they cited the 1973 resolution that Palestinian can and have the right to resist colonial oppression under any means necessary. So this is marks a big departure from the position of most of the Western government. And I like who like even I don't think even Russia is as forthright in the support for the Palestinian resistance as China is. And then, you know, predictably this coverage, you know, there was a very little coverage in the Western mainstream media about China's statement. And whatever little reaction is some, you know, I saw some white women under tweet saying, oh, the statement, I agree with the statement, but I'm not sure if it's China that should be making the statement. They're still committing a genocide against the Uyghurs. And I open up this woman's profile and he's running some kind of PR firm. So she's literally like a show for hire. And then you have Hamas, literally Hamas saying, we appreciate China's position on this. We really appreciate China's support. And then you have some white woman saying, oh, I don't know if China should be the one saying kind of...
What, should Joe Biden say it? Is he going to say, actually, Palestinians can kill whoever they want? You know, like, how's that go?
I think, I mean, the Uyghur genocide is a perfect example of another thing where the convictions of a country are attacking, you know, the morals of another country. All these, you know... Zionists, they constantly say, what could we possibly do? Like, how could we do this better? What do you mean we could do this better? And I mean, and they say there were whatever the 10/7 terrorist attack was so horrible that we just must kill and basically unlimited number of people. And then look at China. There were terrorist attacks in China for several years, I believe. The subway knife attacks and then also the massive riots and did China go around and just massacre like tens of thousands of people? Or I mean this is the funny thing that everyone brought up on the early part of the war, but they kept saying if you proportionally compare it to America, well, if we proportionally compare it to China, how many Uyghurs would we need to be killed to match? And it's totally absurd. And yeah, I think that's one of the reasons you haven't seen that problem as much.
That's the thing. How many Uyghur did China kill, right? Nobody can answer that question. I mean, this is at this point, they're just using Uyghur genocide as a pure distraction from what Israelis are doing in Palestine. Because, you know, I remember, like in 2014 when Israel was bombing Gaza and suddenly, you know, all the mainstream media was flooded with stories about how Xinjiang is the world's largest open air prison. No, I'm sorry, this happened in 2018. And then they suddenly flooded with a story how Xinjiang is the world's largest open air prison. This is so blatant media manipulation, because everybody knows Gaza is the world's largest open air. And they literally just gaming the search engine by flooding the news with calling Xinjiang the largest open air prison in the world. And every time that Israel do some really fucked up shit, you know, you're going to have Uyghur genocide trending on Twitter. I mean, for anybody who is paying attention to stuff, it's just blatant manipulation, but they're still people falling for it. I mean, like, well, I don't know. At this point, I think there's two type of people. There's the truly ignorant and they're liars, right? I mean, these are the two type regularly cite Uyghur genocide to distract from what's the real atrocity that's being committed in Gaza, right?
Yeah, I'm kind of like of two minds of it, because like there are like two types of people, I think. Like there's the one who are just like very obviously just trying to misdirect people's attention to attack China, which is very helpful for America and, you know, kind of Israel. And then, you know, like if there's like an Arab uncle on Facebook and he's like, we got to save this country, this country, this country, this, you know, he's got a big list of all the struggles and he's like, and Palestine. I'm like, whatever, that's fine. At least you've got Palestine in the name. That's cool with me. But like, there's such a, it's so patently obvious. Like you go back to, you know, ISIS or whatever, like all these Islamists that are like very Western backed. They never criticized Israel. They never attacked Israel. They're always looking for a different country to go for. They go kill a bunch of Arabs or Muslims wherever they are instead of, you know, the number one hated thing in the entire Middle East, the broader Muslim world, from Malaysia or from like Palestine to Indonesia. It's the most hated place on earth. You know, why aren't you ever going there? It's a very good issue. It's good PR.
Yeah, it's like Israel, they keep on trying to draw equivalent between Hamas and ISIS. And then ISIS come out with a statement literally criticizing Hamas on only focusing on like a narrow national issues. It's like, you got to be kidding me. Like ISIS, you know, like was largely not saying silent on the current Palestinian the current atrocity in Palestine, and then when they do speak up, they're criticizing Hamas for narrowly focusing on issue focusing on national issues, on national liberation, not focusing on a broader. I mean, it's totally bogus.
It's the most broad struggle. Everybody loves Palestine. We're very popular people. Everybody loves them. You know, it's great. It wins hearts and minds. Like, Jesus Christ. Like, Hamas literally killed every ISIS guy in Gaza. Like, they killed every single one. There was, like, a tiny offshoot of, like, Palestinian ISIS that was most likely fucking funded by the Mossad. You know what they would do? They'd go out into the corner. They had the shittiest rockets. They couldn't build any because they had no friends. They'd shoot off one rocket, and then Israel would fucking assassinate, like, 25 people. You know? Like, the comparison. That's... My God, I forgot about that. That feels like 100 years ago. These wars are normally very short. Like, I kind of chart my life's progress through the wars. And this one being so long has really kind of, like, warped my perception. I feel like it's, you know, it doesn't feel like it's been that long. Let's talk about China in the future, okay? I know China is pretty financially involved with Israel, but it's also financially involved with the other states in the Middle East. I know they've recently helped broker the... like Saudi-Iran rapprochement. What's the future here? I know they own a lot of Haifa. That's where half my family's from. Are they going to shut it down? Are they going to cut them off? What do you think China's like foreign policy in the Middle East looks like 15, 20 years, you know? Like, where's it going?
So before October 7th, China was in a very unique position of having a fairly friendly tie with Iran, with Saudi Arabia and Israel at the same time. But after October 7th, there's a decidedly downturn in the China-Israeli relationship. You know, before our show, I just watched another video where this Israeli commentator said, oh, there's a chill in the relationship between China and Israel after October 7th. You know, look, well, I wonder why, you know, like, what happened in October 7th? What happened after October 7th that prompted this chill in the relationship? You know, maybe all the Israeli atrocities that's committed in Israeli relationship is definitely on the downturn. You know, China-Israeli relationship started, there was a rapprochement that started in the late 90s that continued to the full diplomatic relationship in 1992. At that time, basically, Israel served as a conduit to transfer Western technology particular military technology from like the United States to China. This is something that U.S. has repeatedly complained about.
They keep doing it. They did it with the Soviet Union, too. They just took everybody's shit and sold it to the other guy. They were really fucking double dealing. And America was still backing them up fully. America was getting his fucking, like, pocket picked the entire time. They didn't give a shit. It's shocking how rude they are. They're a very rude country. That's not how you make friends.
Well, I mean, Netanyahu was caught on tapes, you know, like 20 years ago in 2000 saying, like, Yeah, don't worry about America. You know, America is gullible. You know, they will always support us no matter what. And I mean, this is why right now you are seeing is really official propaganda. Is literally them just tweeting out their war crimes, right? And it's almost like they're raising a middle finger to the world, say, you know what, we're just gonna do this. Guess what? You can't do anything because we got the full support of the United States, and they do. But right now, the China-Israel relation is changed. It's definitely entering a downturn. This is if there's ever to be a peace negotiation. I see China possibly could serve the role they did in the Saudi-Iran rapprochement by brokering the Saudi-Iran peace deal.
I think so. I think so. I don't think there's really any illusions that the United States is a good broker for the situation, because up until, I don't know, 2014-ish, the United States was seen, oh, we're going to be in the middle and we'll help these guys figure it out. We don't really know what's going on over here, but we'll help them sort it out. And I don't think anybody buys that anymore. Like, I don't even think Saudi Arabia can go and say that publicly, that America's going to be the one to help broker a peace deal or something. So I think, yeah, China's a very good candidate.
Yeah, I think this is this might be a little bit too much history to go back into, but this is what just really interests me about China's perspective on everything, is they seem to always look for a diplomatic solution first. And war is seen as the absolute last resort, which is supposedly what the US's policy is war is the last resort. But it We're seems to be war. That China has historically, at least since China hasn't been at war since the 70s, right? And they've had numerous territorial disputes with other countries that have been able to have been solved diplomatically. And they've been pushing for, I mean, we briefly touched on this with like the supposed Uyghur genocide. Like, this is, if you're seeing a diplomatic, you're not seeing a hammer first approach. Let's go in and let's just like bash every dude until they stop being Islamists or whatever. Like, let's talk to people and let's try to talk them out of their beliefs or whatever. And you're seeing that within Ukraine as well. China has pushed from the very beginning, let's find a diplomatic solution first. And it's just, it's really, this is really interesting to me, because the US has never been able, they feel like it's just, we got to hit them harder. And if they don't give up, we just hit them even harder. And that just seems absolutely absurd.
Yeah, it's the competency, I think. That's very amazing to me. It's just like, it seems like they're fairly competent as like a government, which is very astounding to us here.
Maybe that's the part that's driving me crazy. Is this a government that's competent?
They can talk normal. They can be normal for an hour without freaking everybody out. There is one thing I wanted to ask you about. So back to the like China Israel like economic relationship, and like Israel just stealing tech and selling it to whoever. There's been pushes. There's been little bubblings coming out of the State Department, trying to get Israel to sever a lot of its economic ties with China, because they've been growing pretty rapidly. And I can very easily see a situation where the U.S. kind of forces Israel to abandon its Chinese economic ties, becoming a much weaker economic power in most respects, and it kind of just untethers whatever incentives are there for China to really continue to support them.
You are exactly right on that. In fact, the biggest push for China for cutting the Israeli-China tie has been United States State Department and Pentagon. You know, U.S. has been hard pressed on Israel for doing military technology transfer to China forever, and United States is the one that's getting upset at the China operated port in Haifa. You know, they have been complaining to Israel about allowing China to take over Haifa port. But you know, lately Israeli position has always also been converging to the U.S. position. You know, you see all these you see Israeli condemning China for Uyghur genocide? I mean, this is the most ridiculous thing, but they have been doing that for the last couple of years. And you see the most right-wing Zionist organizations, group, and people in United States are accusing China of Uyghur genocide, right? And you have the U.S. ambassador to UN, you know, at 1 minute she's tweeting about condemning China for Uyghur genocide. The next minute she's tweeting like, we got to stand behind Israel no matter what. And so that is also, you know, the responsible for the downturn in the China-Israeli ties. United States, the Washington elite right now, they're pushing really hard to decouple, both United States, but all the U.S. vassal states and its proxy decouple from China economically, politically, and to a certain extent, they are working. I mean, especially Europe, you know, because European vassals just can't say no. Same things for Japan and South Korea. Israel, for a while, it has a degree of kind of, you know, they have a bit more leverage. They have more room to maneuver because, you know, because they believe U.S. will support them no matter what. But I think in the end, I think you're right. The final decoupling between Israel and China, the final push is going to come from the United States. And you're also right.
Because I think it's going to be good. I think it's going to be a good development. You know, China or Israel being cut off from the Chinese economy would be fantastic. And China being untethered by any sort of economic incentives, I think, you know, that's a generally positive development for the world. China will survive without the Israeli economy, but I don't know if Israel will.
And you're right. I mean, the biggest benefit, Israel had provided China in the past was to service this conduit for military tech transfer. But that channel is getting shut off by Washington right now. And Haifa port or whatever, China can get another port in Syria. I mean, it's like these ports in East Mediterranean are interchangeable. I mean, and also China is also stepping up its effort to court the Arab world at the present. So it makes much more sense for China to fully align with the Arab world and the Muslim world at this point. So, I mean, it just doesn't make sense for China to stick by Israel the way United States has been doing, basically sacrificing its soft power in the world stage. This is why you are right now seeing...
No, I can't imagine that.
That's why you're yeah. seeing...
Xi Jinping going, we got to support him. We're talking to him. I don't know, man.
And I mean, the NATO military tech is no longer... you know, top of the line, like Iranian drones are just as good and you can get those probably easier if you're not supporting Israel, like,
and much cheaper, you know, like we have seen how it actually works out in the battlefield. Even though United States spend nearly $1 trillion on defense budget, but they cannot supply Ukraine with artillery shells. You know, in the modern battle, land battle, artillery is still king, and Russia is outproducing all the NATO country combined, and you know, Russia and North Korea are outproducing.
Yeah, and North Korea. That's what's impressive.
Yeah, so yeah, I mean,
good for them. Good for North Koreans. I'm very impressed. Yeah, yeah. Okay, guys, we've been having fun for a little bit too long. I think we got to start wrapping things up. I do want to not ask. I'm telling you, please go listen to Silken. This is Carl Jean, the Silken Steel podcast, and many other things. He's been on the news. He surfs. He's very handsome. Also, if you're watching this on his YouTube or if you're listening to this on our audio feed, go watch the video. He's a very handsome young man. He has a loving wife and family. He lives in the sunniest place on earth. He's doing a great time. And he's got great China analysis. I've really found him very valuable. I am working through the chronological history of China. There's so much.
I will say that the beaming, shining face, I felt both me and Vasa were a little shabby, totally unkempt. And then we have this guy who's clean shaven and he looks younger than both of us, even though he's probably 10 years older than both of us.
Yeah. We were scrambling. I'm like, do I need a hat? What do I do? Should I put on a suit?
I was born in 1976, so you guys can call me Uncle Carl.
Oh my God.
All right, guys.
Well, you absolutely look great. And you. The lighting in your video is really great. Bali is doing you wonders. The stress-free life.
All right, guys. How do we usually end this? You're right. Free Palestine, fuck the police.
Free
All
Palestine. Right. Have a great day.
Free Palestine.
Hey, 带来远处的硝烟，迷茫的战火，遍体鳞伤的消息。
人群居住飘零，颠簸破碎的心。
那白昼已变成黑夜，地狱已幸福天堂。
唱出世界和平，伸出你的双手。
看那遍地的血流，千疮百孔的面容。
苍天飞舞烟尘，大地布满裂纹。
那奔涌洪流的泪水，淹没了生命渴望。
唱出世界和平，伸出你的双手。
熊熊的燃烧不停，
和平唤醒清晨，天地光彩重生，
让和风拂出的音响谱成生命的乐章。
唱出世界和平，伸出你的双手，让我拥抱
祈祷。